Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And Craig, two topics today I've been looking forward to talking about on the podcast for a long time. One, the 1928 hurricane. We will do that in depth momentarily. But two, black bears, one of Florida's great native wild animals that we've yet to really discuss in any sort of detail on the show. But you, in one of your recent Florida Phoenix columns, were writing about black bears.
Yeah, I heard about this pretty horrific case of bear poaching and and just got really interested in the subject and wanted to write about the poachers and how they're getting, you know, it was pretty horrific. They were using dogs to chase down the bears. They had lured the bears in with donuts they'd stolen from a Krispy Kreme, and then they were using the dogs to chase bears in the Ocala National Forest, a place where you would think the bears would be protected.
And
they're getting, you know, most of these nine defendants were pleading out to probation sentences. This one guy pleaded out and got 364 days in jail, plus he had to give up his dogs that he trained to chase bears. It just seems like a slap on the wrist. And I wanted to write about that. And a lot of people, a lot of newcomers to Florida don't even know we have bears and have no idea that they're living in bear habitat until suddenly, you know, bear shows up swinging in their backyard swing or chilling in their hot tub.
They're not common, but they're certainly not uncommon either. And these are black bears, smaller than we think grizzly bears out west and attacking people in the huge Kodiak standing 12 feet tall. That's not the sort of bears we have here. The black bears that really live throughout the entire eastern part of the United States and out west as well. Fortunately, your story, in addition, and boy, this is Florida. While there are a lot of villains, there's a hero as well.
Yeah, I wrote, there was a woman named Katrina Shaddix. We actually had a Florida bear hunt in 2015, which was extremely unpopular. The hunters killed so many bears, they ended it after 2 days instead of taking a whole week. And it galvanized her into action to start doing stuff for the bears. And one of the things she did was pass on a tip to the Wildlife Commission about these poachers. And also she worked to get a bill passed by the legislature to increase at least a little bit the penalties for poachers. It shows you the difference one person can make.
Sure. FloridaPhoenix.com. I'm sure we'll do more bear material down the road at some point, but we have...
If we can bear it.
Yes. We've got a lot to get to today. And I want to thank again the folks at Visit Sarasota. If you missed last week's bonus episode with the summer preview, go check that out, because a lot of what we discussed, you need to act on right away. Savor Sarasota, the first couple of weeks of June, that's their big restaurant week where they've got all the deals and specials and so many restaurants from around the area offering opportunities for you to come in and get a prefix menu at a very reasonable rate. And all of the summer events and activities that we preview in that bonus episode with Nate Sweetman from Visit Sarasota. But something else to act on quick. If you can get to Myakka River State Park in the next couple of weeks, this episode's going to publish on May 31st. You might still be able to see the full-on Coreopsis bloom, the Florida state flower, that spindly kind of yellow flower. They've got fields and fields of it at Myakka River State Park. It is an amazing sight for photographs and to just stand in awe of nature. If you can get to Myakka River State Park early June or next year, late May, early June for the Coreopsis bloom down there in Sarasota County, you will not regret it. Visit Sarasota.com to learn more. And that takes us now to a topic I've wanted to cover on the podcast ever since we began in the summer of 2020, and that is the 1928 hurricane.
Yes. And it's a very timely topic because hurricane season starts officially June 1st. So here's a good cautionary tale for all you newcomers to Florida about a Category 5 storm that hit the state, and hardly anybody knows about it today.
Yeah, Elliot Kleinberg is our guest. He wrote the book on the hurricane, Black Cloud, the Great Florida Hurricane of 1928. You can find Elliot online, ekfla.com. Now, the state had a big hurricane in 26. Andrew, people are familiar with. Michael, people are familiar with. We'll probably do future episodes about all of those. But the big one was 1928
yes.
with the massive death toll, sadly, and the huge implications on what Florida would become.
And if people know about it, they probably know about it only from reading Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston.
Well, now you'll know about it from Elliot Kleinberg.
Yes. Elliot, thanks so much for being our guest today for this very timely topic. First of all, let me ask you, you were a reporter for the Palm Beach Post. Did that lead you into writing this book about the 1928 Okeechobee hurricane?
Yeah, people ask me all the time, what led me to this hurricane? Well, you know, I am a Florida native. Many people, when they meet me, they say, oh, I didn't know there were any. I grew up with hurricanes. My dad was the editor of the afternoon paper in Miami, so I certainly knew about how hurricanes were covered. We lost a car to flooding in a hurricane. My first real job as a reporter was covering Hurricane David for a Miami radio station in 1979. It didn't hit, but it came close enough to scare the heck out of everybody in Southeast Florida. When I got to the Palm Beach Post in 1987, there were two things I presumed that were both wrong. One was I thought that growing up in Miami, I knew all about Palm Beach County. And the other is that growing up with hurricanes, I knew all about hurricanes and I knew every major hurricane. a year later in 1988, the newspaper sent me out to the interior around Lake Okeechobee, where they were holding the 60th anniversary commemoration of the 1928 hurricane. And I got out there and I said to myself, how do I not know about this hurricane? So I interviewed many old timers who within a decade would be gone. And something told me to save my notes. About a year later, a pioneer whose dad had been the first mayor of Delray Beach sold the home that the family had owned since 1902. And she was already in her 80s. So she just couldn't keep up with it anymore. So I wrote the story. I turned it in. Craig, you'll appreciate this as a former newspaper reporter, because I'm sure this happened to you. I turned in my story. This is before internet. So you didn't see your story until you saw it the next morning in the driveway. I pick up the story, and I had mentioned that she was so proud that her house had stood up to the 1928 hurricane. When I saw the story in the paper, some copy editor had changed it to read that she was proud that her house had stood up to a 1928 hurricane. So I went into my editor and I said, Tom, there was not a attack on Pearl Harbor, and there was not a shooting in Dallas in 1963. This arguably is the most important event in the history of the county for which we are the newspaper of record. And the more I thought about it, as we started to get close to the 75th anniversary in 2003, and between 1988 and 2000, I wrote numerous stories about this hurricane, interviewed many people. And as we started getting in the neighborhood of the 75th anniversary, I had done many special sections for the paper. We had done a couple of commemorative books, history books. And I said, does this need to be a special section? I think it needs to be a book. So I talked to the editors and they said, you know, we don't want to do a book on it. And I said, well, I'd like to, and I'd like to do it on the side. And they said, have at it.
For people who are new to Florida, of which we have a lot, tell them why the 1928 hurricane is so significant. And you might mention that it followed one just 2 years before.
What I tell people is that the 1928 hurricane very likely is the most underreported disaster in the history of the United States. This storm killed more people than any hurricane on the North American mainland, except for the great Galveston hurricane of 1900, which I'll be happy to be second to. But this 1928 hurricane killed probably 3,000 people.
Wow.
And no one ever heard of it. People never heard of it. What I tell people is that you need to know about this hurricane for many reasons. One is that it was a very important event. Number two, people think that history is in the abstract because they are victims of, and I know there's probably some history teachers out there, I'm probably going to offend you, but a lot of people are victims of teachers who teach history in a boring way, and they teach it in an abstraction that people can't grasp. Well, if you want to know the legacy of the 1928 hurricane, all you've got to do is drive around Lake Okeechobee. You can't see the lake. Why? Because there's this massive dome surrounding it to keep the water from rushing out and drowning people. Mm-hmm. How much less abstract do you need to be?
And we as taxpayers had to pay for that, of course, and still do.
They spent four decades building that thing, and they're still working on it because it still leaks.
Mm-hmm.
What I tell people is that after the storm killed everybody, the people of Florida and the United States had to decide between two options. The first was to abandon the interior back to nature. That never happens. So the only other option was to make something so big that it would never happen again. And as people say, we're still paying for it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's start out wide and then we'll narrow in on Florida and then eventually Lake Okeechobee. You think hurricanes, you think the coast, not Lake Okeechobee, but that is one of the unique and provocative details of this story is how it impacted the water at Lake Okeechobee. This storm, like you talked about, thousands of deaths, an accurate, you know, figure will never be known, but many thousands from the Caribbean all the way to Canada. So this is not a Florida story like you talked about. This is a North American continent story. Talk about the scale broadly of the story before we drill down to Florida.
My research led me to believe, based on everything I read about it, that this storm might have killed as many as 6,000 people, starting in the islands and working its way up through North America. It drowned a couple of people at a convention in New Jersey.
Wow.
And I was able to get documents from the Canadians who still were tracking this thing. This is 1928 technology. They were still able to track this thing in Northern Ontario. So yeah. this thing was really big. And what I talk about in the book is that because of the technology at the time, they didn't have satellites. And the first anybody knew that this hurricane was out there, we don't know when it came off the coast of Africa. Clearly, it must have come off the coast of Africa because it was one of those late season monsters, or height of the season monsters. It almost absolutely was a Cape Verde storm. The first anybody noticed of it was a few hundred miles east of one of the easternmost islands when a ship ran into it. And they wrote to the authorities that they were in this thing and the wind freshened, which is a wonderful all-term. Wow. What a wonderful understatement. The wind freshened. Somehow they survived the storm. They got into port and they said, this thing's getting pretty bad. And then it started hitting these little islands. The good thing about being a little tiny island in the Caribbean is that you're a very small target and the odds of actually getting hit are low because you're a dot in the middle of the ocean. The bad thing about being a little island is if a hurricane hits you, you got nowhere to run.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of little islands that got absolutely pummeled, almost raked clean. After the hurricane went through all these islands, it took aim at Puerto Rico. And what I say in the book is that if the storm had died after striking Puerto Rico, people would have written books about the great 1928 Puerto Rico hurricane. I think the official death toll was a few hundred, but it might have killed 1,000 people there. If you're familiar at all with the geography of Puerto Rico, it's a long tobacco leaf shaped island with a mountain range right in the middle. And so everything either washes down one side of the mountain range or down the other.
Mm-hmm.
So when the rains came, they just washed everything away. We're talking about the 1920s. So a lot of people lived in tin shacks that were really just three pieces of zinc stuck together. And in the wind, these things became flying daggers, flying guillotines. And yes, that many people were literally cut to pieces by these things.
Wow.
Now, there's an old thing, and it's kind of a wives' tale. It's not consistent. There's no science to it, but it's kind of a good thing to watch, especially if you live in the southeast coast of Florida. When a hurricane is coming, especially a bad one, watch how it comes off Puerto Rico. If it comes straight west from the island, it's probably going to go into the island of Hispaniola, which is Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And that's where the giant mountains of Hispaniola, which is the highest mountains in the Caribbean, are going to tear up the hurricane the same way you would stick a crowbar into the spokes of a bicycle wheel. If it comes straight north from Puerto Rico, chances are it's going to go up into the open ocean, maybe threaten Long Island, run out of gas when the water starts getting cold around Norfolk, and probably never bother anybody. if it comes out of Puerto Rico at a northwest angle, better start getting worried. And that's what this one did. And what I do in my book, because I love drama, is that in each chapter leading up to the landfall, I do the chapter on the islands, and at the end I'll say the hurricane now was X miles from Florida. And then I talk about what it did in Puerto Rico, and I say the hurricane now was X miles from Florida. And the last thing the hurricane hit was the Bahamas. And the Bahamas were devastated. If you're familiar with Nassau, Paradise Island back then was an island called Hog Island because it was literally used to raise pigs. And that island was just devastated. Everything was knocked down. And the people of the Bahamas said, anybody in America wants to help us, we could sure use your help. But as the guy says in Casablanca, pretty soon Florida would not be able to help even itself, because the storm now was about 200 miles from Florida.
So how much warning did people in Florida get?
Well, okay. For many, many years, people made a big deal about supposedly that people in Florida didn't get enough warning. If you're familiar with a book called Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is one of my favorite Florida books of all time, It's loosely based on this hurricane. Now, the author, Zora Neale Hurston, one of the most overrated writers in America, wasn't here for the storm. She was in the Bahamas. She was in the Caribbean. But she had lived in the Glades, and she came back and interviewed many people and used the storm as the basis for her novel. In her novel, the Seminoles are walking, and they're where are you going? Where are you going? Oh, we're running away because the sawgrass is blooming. That means the hurricane is coming. And people actually believe this. Well, two things. Number one, Seminoles were killed in the hurricane. Number two, you didn't have to see the sawgrass blooming, because it was on the front page of the Palm Beach Post that a hurricane was out there and might threaten Florida. Now, here's what happened. The forecasters of the 1920s did not have satellites. They did not have planes that could fly into the hurricane. They did not have radar. There's another thing that their modern counterparts had that they didn't have, which is humility. The Hurricane Office, which at the time was in Jacksonville, put out a statement, I think on Friday. The storm hit Sunday morning. They said, this storm is not going to hit Florida. Now, you might recall that when Andrew, even as it was bearing down on Homestead, they still had a hurricane warning up between Vero Beach and Key West, because the forecasters knew that hurricanes can do a lot of things. Well, in 1928, 48 hours before landfall, they said, oh, this hurricane is going to miss Florida altogether. Well, Saturday afternoon, again, the hurricane first made the first winds of the hurricane showed up Sunday morning. On Saturday afternoon, the forecasters said, and this is one of my favorite, talk about a wonderful piece of bureaucratic covering your you know what. They said, recurve, not yet indicate. Now, here's what they meant by that. We all know that hurricanes have a tendency, as they come through the Caribbean, to make a turn to the north. Now, if they make the turn early enough, they go up through the middle of the ocean and, as people like to say, race to their death in the chilly waters of the North Atlantic, or they become a fish storm. Well, these forecasters had been absolutely convinced that this storm was going to curve straight north after it came off Puerto Rico. Well, it eventually did curve to the north, or somewhere around Sebring. So the forecaster comes out on Saturday afternoon and he says, recurve not yet indicated. Now, all of a sudden, people know that this hurricane is going to hit. Now, there are people, you know, they say, oh, nobody was prepared, it caught them off guard. No, there were many people that were doing, especially on the coast of Palm Beach County, Broward County, up along the Treasure Coast, people were preparing for the storm along the coast. But back then, who heard the flawed forecast and who heard the corrected forecast? There was no CNN. There was no TV. Radio was
no weather channel.
Radio was in its infancy and was a luxury. Remember, we're talking 1928. The Depression was just starting to get going. And the newspaper, now Craig and I were both in the newspaper business. We love our newspapers, but the newspaper is only as good as whatever somebody said 12 hours ago. So when the guy said on Saturday afternoon, you know, this thing might hit, is probably going to hit Florida, what he said landed in people's driveways Sunday morning and were immediately blown away as the hurricane was coming ashore. But here's the other point. Even if you heard the corrected forecast and you knew it was time to flee the Glades, number one, how would you hear it? Like I said, you may not have had a radio. But even if you wanted to flee, at the time, there were only three ways out of the southeast corner of Lake Okeechobee. There was the highway to Fort Myers, which had not been built yet. So you couldn't go that way. There was a two-lane road that follows the east shore of Lake Okeechobee, Highway 98. I was on it about 6 months ago. It's still a slow ride. And the only other place you would go is east to the coast. Well, you're not going to go there. That's where the hurricane's coming.
Right.
So really, people had nowhere to go.
Now, I was intrigued when reading your book that they had a system of flags to warn people.
The Weather Service used these hurricane flags. They still do, I think, officially. They still do it just for the sake of tradition. If you ever go to a University of Miami game, I'm a Gator, but I've been to a few Miami games. They come out and they wear those. They have those flags. And it's a red square with a black square in the middle. And that means a tropical storm. If you fly two flags like that, it means a hurricane. And so, again, people didn't have TV, radio. So you go outside and you go outside the weather office and they've raised these double flags. And if you didn't know it already, you're like, okay, a hurricane's coming.
Let's dig into the Lake Okeechobee part of this where much of the tragedy occurs. When does the storm arrive and how does the geography and how does this, to use another storm metaphor, essentially become a perfect storm of disaster with this hurricane and Lake Okeechobee and where the people around the lake happen to be living?
Okay, here's what happened. The hurricane comes ashore, probably somewhere along the West Palm Beach, Lake Worth city line. The eye probably stretched from Lake Park, which is up near Riviera Beach, which is north of West Palm, and south all the way to Delray Beach, which means it was about a 40-mile eye.
Wow.
We know that this hurricane blew out windows in Vero Beach, and it blew out windows in Miami. We know that it knocked trains off the track in Deerfield Beach. If you can follow the geography of this was a massive, massive storm. It hit the coast, did tremendous damage along the West Palm Beach coast. And then it went inland. Now, people have this theory if they're dumb, that a hurricane strikes the coast and falls apart like a vase. Hurricane David, the first hurricane I covered, caused mudslides in the Shenandoah Valley that drowned dozens of people. The 1928 hurricane, as I mentioned, was still being tracked as a tropical storm in Ontario. So for the hurricane to cross 30, 40 miles from the coast to Lake Okeechobee was not a big deal. We don't know how fast this hurricane's winds were. It's quite possible that it was a Category 5, which would be 155 miles an hour sustained, which I don't know if you can comprehend what a sustained 155 mile an hour wind is. When, next time you want to stick your head out the window when you're going 60 miles an hour in your car, this is 155 sustained. And we also know that, like earthquakes, hurricanes are exponential. For every 10 or 20 miles an hour in wind speed, the potential for damage doubles. So people say, well, why didn't the hurricane lose all its strength between the coast and the lake? I said, it's 30 miles. That's nothing to a hurricane. And by the way, it was 30 miles of swamp, which we all know that hurricanes feed on warm water. Mm-hmm. So the next question people say is, well, if the hurricane was coming from the east, why did it push all the water from the lake out towards the southeast? That doesn't make any sense. Well, yes, it does. A hurricane is essentially a gigantic tornado. It's a gigantic cyclone, and it moves counterclockwise. That's why sometimes the winds are coming from the north, sometimes coming from the south, even if the hurricane is coming at you from the east. So this hurricane came in around the West Palm Lake Worth line and angled a bit to the northwest, which brought the center of the storm at the north end of Lake Okeechobee. Now, the key to all of this, the thing that made this a perfect storm, was Lake Okeechobee. It comes from the Indian word for big water. It's huge. You can't, you stand on one end, you can't see the other side. You
can see it's the second largest in the country, isn't it? Second largest lake.
Yeah. It's the second largest freshwater lake wholly within the confines of North America. It's so big, you can see it from satellites. Mm-hmm. And it's got enough water in it to give like a glass of water to every person on the planet. But here's the important thing about Lake Okeechobee. It is shallow. What I tell people is if you want to get an idea of Lake Okeechobee, fill a frying pan with water and walk across your kitchen floor and try not to spill any water. Mm-hmm. Lake Okeechobee is like 12 feet deep, 20 feet deep. This is nothing, right? People always wonder, like, you know, why the Gulf Coast gets so much damage from a hurricane coming up into like Fort Myers or Sanibel or Port Charlotte. It's because the Gulf is very shallow. And on the East Coast, where Palm Beach is, the water is very deep. And as the storm is coming in, the deep water manages to assuage much of the energy. So you don't get as bad of a storm surge. You go down to Miami, where Biscayne Bay is only 10 feet deep, and you end up with sailboats in trees, which is what happened in Andrew. So the hurricane comes ashore in Palm Beach, but because the water is so deep, the storm surge was limited. Now it's crossing over to one of the largest freshwater lakes on the planet, and it's only 12 to 20 feet deep. So this hurricane is now coming in one of the largest lakes on the planet, and it's only 12 to 20 feet deep. It comes to the north end of the lake, and you have to understand that they've had storm events on Lake Okeechobee where one end of the lake is 8 feet higher above sea level than the other end.
Wow.
Of course, it doesn't matter now because there's a dike. Mm-hmm. But in the 1928 storm, as it approached the north end of the lake, there was a fellow at the National Hurricane Center who told me that had it been daylight, you might have seen fish flopping around on the lake bed right around the docks of Okeechobee City, because the storm came from the north and pushed all those trillions of gallons of water down to the southeast corner, the only place where there were a lot of people.
Man.
Well, when Governor Broward, for whom the county is named, he ran for governor on a platform to drain the Everglades because he believed it would expose the richest farm soil in the world. Well, he was right, but what he didn't realize is that the soil dries up and blows away, and probably in another 50 years, we're going to have the world's largest skating rink because it's all going to be just limestone. When he drained the Everglades, farmers were invited to come in. We're not talking about the big sugar industry. That didn't come until the 30s and 40s. We're talking about mom and pops growing peppers and cabbage and stuff like that, lettuce. And these guys started complaining. They said, you know, every time there's a pretty decent storm, the water just oozes out of Lake Okeechobee and drowns our crops. So the state said, okay, no problem. And they built a 6-foot berm around the south shore of the lake that would hold it in. They just took the muck and they just pushed it like Play-Doh and made a 6-foot high berm. Well, boy, that's going to solve the problem. The next time 140 mile an hour wind pushes trillions of gallons of water out of the lake. So 1926 comes along. We all know about the great 1926 Miami hurricane. But what a lot of people don't know is that it continued up through the state. In fact, it did damage to the Gamble Mansion up in Bradenton. But before it got to Bradenton, it hit the town of Moorhaven, which if you imagine Lake Okeechobee like a giant clock, Moorhaven's at about 8 o'clock. It was a town, pretty decent sized town at the time. And this little muck dike, this little 6-foot high dike made out of Play-Doh lasted about 3 minutes and 600 people drowned.
Wow.
And so everybody got together and said, we need to get together and build a bigger dike. And they were arguing and arguing and arguing. And they were still arguing about 2 years later in 1928. And somebody said, well, what if another hurricane comes? And then somebody said, what are the odds of a hurricane hitting the same place 2 years apart?
Famous last words.
Yeah.
So the 1928 hurricane comes over to the north end of Lake Okeechobee. It washes trillions of gallons of water down to the southeast corner. This makeshift berm made out of literally clay probably lasted 30 seconds. And as the night wore on, the water rose to 20 feet above the land. I did interviews with people who were grabbing onto pieces of wood, floating in waves, storm waves, and under their feet were sugarcane.
Man. So, and it didn't rise rapidly, though. It rose kind of slowly, right?
Yeah, you know, people who read The Eyes Are Watching God think there was a tidal wave. And there wasn't. There was a slow and steady rise in the water. In fact, one of the people I interviewed, his father had come down to help work on the roadbed for US 27 from Clewiston out to Fort Myers. And as you know, here in Florida, you don't just lay down a road. You've got to put in fill to get it up above, get it high up so that it doesn't flood every time there's rain. Everybody wonders why all these canals all over Florida, a lot of them are fill canals. They took the dirt out, used it to raise the roadbed, and then filled the hole with the ditch with water. So they were building the roadbed for 27 when the storm hit. And this guy, his name was Bernie Boots, and he was 14 years old. And so they're in the house, and they can see the water rising, rising, rising. Actually, this was another lady I interviewed. The water's rising, and they climb up. And I'm reading this, and it's like reading a horror story. Like, I had to turn my lights on. I was reading it at night. I had to turn the lights on. The water's coming up, and they said, we got to climb on the dining table. And then it's up above the dining table. And they said, we got to get in the attic. And they get in the attic, and the water is in the attic. And they're like, well, we can't stay in the attic. We'll drown. So they punch a hole in the attic, and there's the hurricane. And one member of the family literally blew away in the attic.
Wow.
So not far from there is Bernie Boots' house. And what happened to that house is that the water lifted it up off its foundations. Well, houses were not built to work as boats. Mm-hmm. The house came off the foundation, floated to the roadbed that Bernie's dad had been building, hit it, bounced off, hit it again, bounced off, hit it a third time, and the house fell apart. Mm-hmm. The next thing Bernie knows, again, he's 14. Is that he's holding on to a roof joist and he's in, I don't know, 10-foot waves, and the wind is screaming and he can't see anybody. And finally, sometime in the middle of the night, he dozes off. And when he opens his eyes, the sun is out and he starts screaming. I saw him do this as an oral history thing. I saw the tape. He starts screaming, and he hears a voice, and it's the voice of his brother. And at this point in the oral history, Bernie can't talk. He's so choked with emotion. Now, you would think he'd be choked with emotion talking about his house falling down. But he's choked with emotion telling the part about when he realized he was not the last person left on.
Wow.
Wow. Not the last person left on the planet, because it would seem that way. And it's easy for us to sit here in the cool afternoon of a podcast, but you have to, when you're hearing these stories, think about the noise. Think of how noisy 140 mile an hour winds would be, the screaming, the screeching, how afraid these people would be. Part of this takes place at dark. Think of how hard the rain is. You know, there's no emergency, you know, communication. There's the cavalry is not coming. You are 100% on your own, live or die, right here, building materials. Obviously, houses aren't built the way they are today. It is the apocalypse, nothing less than that. And it was, sadly, for many people, many of whom Black citizens ended up in a mass grave, correct?
People ask me, why do you call the book Black Cloud? And actually, it was a buddy of mine in Tampa that gave me the idea. And it's got several meanings. There's black cloud as in an ominous storm coming. There's a black cloud of the storm itself. There's the black funeral, the black smoke from where they just took bodies and piled them up into funeral pyres and burned them, because they had to get these bodies either buried or burned because they were worried about illness. And the other reason I called it Black Cloud was because of the issue of race. Now, the issue of race is almost as big. I always say that the storm and the lake were characters in the book. They weren't just places. They're actual characters. And race was almost as big a part of this book as the hurricane itself.
We promise not to tell the governor, so continue.
Because in 1928, Florida was Jim Crow. Now, I remember when I was editing the book, the editor calls me up and he says, Elliot, I'm confused. Who made the decision to put the white victims in one mass grave and the black victims in another? And I said, Philip, were you sleeping in history class? And he says, no, Florida. I said, well, Florida now is very diverse. But in 1928, Florida was part of the Deep South, and Jim Crow was the law. And so many of the victims were poor black. I say right at the front of the book, if this hurricane had drowned 3,000 white businessmen in downtown West Palm, or if it would have smashed a black tie affair out on Palm Beach, they'd still be talking about it. But it killed mostly poor black migrant workers, many of whom the boss didn't even know their whole name. And when it came time to build the mass grave, they put all the whites in a small mass grave in the city cemetery, and they put all the blacks, they went to a pauper's grave in the black neighborhood, dug a giant hole, and dumped into it 674 bodies. That's not the tragedy. The tragedy is that for the next six decades, that mass grave stood unmarked. In fact, at one point, they rerouted part of the street so that part of the street was under the grave. Now, I took my kids to Gettysburg when they were in high school.
Was it over the grave or under?
The street was over the grave.
Over the grave, yeah.
I took my kids to Gettysburg when they were in high school, and you can't go 10 feet without seeing a marker where some guy twisted his ankle. But here's a spot, I call it the most under-respected historic site in all of America. There is a spot that holds 700 people, and not just 700 people, 700 victims of one of the greatest disasters in U.S. history that you never heard of.
I remember reading this in the book, that there was a guy who went out and rescued white people ahead of the storm from around the lake, but didn't say anything about rescuing any of the black people that worked there.
Well, there are many stories about white people worrying only about their white friends. There are stories, to be fair, of white farmers who did try to protect their black workers. But clearly, you get the idea, and it's hard for people to understand this now, or maybe not so hard. Blacks were second-class citizens, and in some cases, they were expendable, especially if they were migrants from the Caribbean. They, you know, what was the priority for them? And in fairness, there are white farmers who died in their homes around the lake because there was nowhere to run when the water came. But clearly, race played a huge part of it. And then, of course, many blacks were commandeered to help with the cleanup, help with the body collection, weren't paid, weren't allowed to leave when they wanted to leave. So race is a huge part of the story.
And to continue with the race angle, reading a synopsis of the book, it quotes, the hurricane was colorblind, recovery and rebuilding were not. What is meant by that? And then we'll start moving forward and talking about the legacy of this storm. Yeah.
Well, sure. You know, like I said, many blacks died because they were migrant workers who lived in a shanty, or some of these guys didn't even have a house. They just, at the end of the day, they just laid down under a tree. Clearly, helping blacks who had been injured in the storm was not a high priority. The recovery, you know, many people died of illness, and clearly there were two different sets of rules on how to help white victims versus black victims.
What were the rules? How were they different?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was 1928, you know, white victims were given top priority. Black victims were either second class or invisible. You know, we don't have time for that. We don't have time to help black people. We got to worry about the white people.
Was there any national effort at attempting to come in and help?
Yes. People, you have to understand, there was no FEMA in 1928, but there was an American Red Cross. And actually, the 1928 hurricane was the second major disaster that the Red Cross handled. The first one was a series of floods along the Mississippi River around New Orleans and Mississippi the previous year, 1927, which there's also been books written about.
Oh, yeah.
So the Red Cross came in 1928, tried to help out. They met all sorts of obstacles. People didn't appreciate them helping black people. but they did come in and they tried desperately to help as many people as they could. But you got to remember, you know, it wasn't just the Glades. The coastal area had not as many fatalities, but had tremendous structural damage. Many homes were smashed, businesses, and also they were just getting on the edge of the depression. So it wasn't a great time to have a hurricane knock your house down. And there was one story about houses that back when they built them back then, they didn't have the code they had now. They didn't bolt houses down. The house just laid on the slab by its weight.
Yeah.
And the only time that would become an issue is if you had 155 mile an hour hurricane. So there were houses down in Lantana near West Palm that had slid 6 inches on their slab. Mm. Well, those houses had to get knocked down. They weren't good anymore. You couldn't live in a house 6 inches.
Was there actually even an effort to claim that it wasn't as bad as it seemed? I remember reading that somewhere.
Some writers have suggested that authorities tried to push the hurricane under the rug because they didn't want bad publicity for Florida. That's a gross exaggeration. There was a columnist for the Tampa paper who wrote several columns suggesting that the damage wasn't as bad as he thought until some people who had been over there sent him straight on that. Many papers in the North were more than happy to beat up on Florida and make the hurricane sound as horrible as possible because they were tired of everybody moving to Florida. But clearly, everyone in the country knew how horrific this hurricane had been. There were school projects to collect pennies to send to the people in Florida. So really, everybody pretty much knew how bad it had been.
You mentioned, and Craig mentioned, all the dikes and walls and drainage around Lake Okeechobee as an obvious remnant of this storm. What was the other, you know, lasting impact that you can still see in the state of Florida that comes out of the 1928 hurricane?
Well, actually, I would say that except for the dike, the greatest tragedy of the storm is that there's not a lot of places where you can see about the storm. No monuments, no markers, no big deal around the mass graves. And yet the legacy of this hurricane is so profound, which makes it even a greater crime that so few people have heard about it. And of course, number one, with a bullet, is that the greatest loss of life in the history of Florida in a hurricane was not from winds knocking down buildings, was not from a massive wave coming ashore from the ocean, but from freshwater flooding. Go figure. How many times have you heard forecasters and emergency managers say it's not the wind, it's the water, the water, the water? Hurricane Andrew, never before had so many people been threatened by so powerful a hurricane. Never happened. Not even Katrina, not even nothing. And yet Hurricane Andrew, Category 5 hurricane hitting the largest metropolitan area in Florida and one of the largest metro areas in America. There were probably 500,000 people who experienced Category 5 winds. Think about that. Mm-hmm. How many people died in Andrew? 15.
Yeah.
15. Wow. Why? Because it was a dry storm, it was a fast storm, it was a tight-knit storm, and it was off and gone. And if you locked in yourself in your house, you probably were okay, especially because houses in 1992 were built a lot better than they were built in 1928. And by the way, after Andrew, they discovered that the houses and buildings could have been built even better. And now, if you're in a house, what I tell people is, the one place on the planet that I want to be when the hurricane is threatening my house is in my house. I don't want to be on the interstate trying to get to Macon and worry about the storm hitting my car. I don't want to be sitting in a hotel room in Ocala watching CNN as the storm is smashing my house and then trying to get back to my house to get something on the roof, because how many of these hurricanes are followed by a big thunderstorm?
Yeah.
I want to be in my house. Now, if you emotionally can't handle it, I certainly respect that, but I want to be in my house. And I also know that I'm not going to drown, because I know that my house is on high ground and I don't have to worry about the ocean or the lake. I'm not near either one. So the moral of the story of the great 1928 hurricane, besides the horrific racial attitudes that were their own tragedy, the great legacies of the 1928 storm are two. Number one is preparation, which people have been trying to hammer into people's, you know, heads forever. You know, people in Oklahoma, you know how much warning they get? 90 seconds. People in California, and I got a kid living in San Francisco right now, it makes me nervous. People in California get 3 seconds. People in Florida get 3 days. What's your, not only do they get 3 days, but people know right now, at the beginning of the summer, that they're about to enter hurricane season. There's no earthquake off season, and there's no tornado off season, but there is a hurricane off season, and that's when you should buy the panels. That's when you should check the roof of your house. That's when you should get your batteries, your water, make sure you have the shutters, the storm panels, whatever. Hurricane damage and hurricane deaths are more preventable than in any other natural disaster on the planet. So that's the legacy of the storm. And of course, the biggest legacy of the storm is, like I said, the water, the water, the water. And maybe the most profound symbolic or you want to get into some really deep legacy of the storm is that we messed with Mother Nature.
Yeah.
We took a lake in the middle of the state and we drained all of the land around it and put farms around it. And anybody with any brains, and people wrote Marjorie Stoneman Douglas's father, who ran the editorial pages of the Miami Herald, wrote saying this is going to cause an ecological disaster. But of course, people had stars in their eyes, or actually they had dollar signs in their eyes. So maybe that's the greatest lesson, but good luck with that.
Did writing this book change you and change your attitudes?
Oh, God, yes. It was very humbling for me as a journalist and historian to find out how little I knew about a major event. It was like, Craig, when you were in the newspaper business, you might see something in the other paper and you say, how the heck did I miss this? Mm-hmm. Well, for me, even early on, I was already starting to cover hurricanes for the Palm Beach Post, and I had covered hurricanes at other places where I had worked. And I said to myself, how on earth did I miss this gigantic hurricane? Over the next several years, I became the hurricane writer for the paper and covered many hurricanes and wrote the annual preparation guide that we would put out.
Yeah.
For me as a journalist and a historian, it was a great learning experience on how to research and write something like this. I'd never tried a book before. All of my books before that were collections of things I had already written. So to write a gigantic story from beginning to end was quite a challenge. So it was for me as a journalist, as a historian, and as a Floridian, because it made me realize that I could help save people's lives. I mean, I know that sounds dramatic, but, you know, if people will listen, you know, you want to bang it into their head. You can survive this hurricane. You can limit the damage to your house. Here's how. Why aren't you doing it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Elliot Kleinberg has been our guest. The book, Black Cloud, The Great Florida Hurricane of 1928. There's a link to purchase in the show notes. Find Elliot online, ekfla.com.
Before we go, I just have to mention, Elliot, I owe you a huge debt of gratitude because, of course, your books on Weird Florida helped to lay the groundwork for my book, Oh Florida. So thank you.
Craig, you've always told people that you've always given me the credit, and I appreciate that.
Elliot, thank you much for your time today. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having me.
A conversation, a topic I've been looking forward to discussing on the podcast for a long time, and man, it lived up to all my expectations.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's such a huge event in Florida history that most people have no idea about. And I think about it every June 1st, you know, start of hurricane season.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, my mom, every June 1st, would pull out one of those, you probably have never even seen it, a map with a blue grid on it that was a hurricane map that they gave out for free from the radio station. And she would immediately start plotting. She'd tune into the radio, turn into the weather reports. And if there was a cloud off the coast of Africa, she'd start plotting the course to see which way it would go. Wow. And when I was a kid, I thought that she was actually shielding our house from being hit by a hurricane by doing that. This is like a little ritual. so that was sort of my introduction to hurricanes. And then we actually had one, and it was pretty traumatic.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the dangers of being able to say, welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.